So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. I'm going to take a look at wetlands in Wisconsin and beyond and take a look at our environment, not only here in this state, but globally today as we visit with a couple of guests to start our program. One guest with us by phone today is Carl Safina. His most recent book is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. It is a fascinating book, and I was talking with Judith, my producer. We were both agreeing that we could probably take a chapter, each chapter, and do a whole program on each of his chapters. And we'll get Carl. Are you there?
I'm here, Larry. Thank you.
Oh, it's a wonderful book, and Carl's going to be speaking at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association conference. It's going to be in Baraboo in mid-February. And so Katie Balfus joins us as well from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. She's Outreach Programs Director, so we'll talk a little bit as well about that Wisconsin Wetlands Association conference and also about what the organization does and helping our wetlands. And Katie, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me. And hi, Carl. Great to hear you.
Hi, Katie.
And you can join in with your own questions or comments as we move along here today. The toll-free number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And Katie, you must be excited to have Carl coming as the speaker.
I'm just thrilled. I've heard so many amazing things about him. I can't wait to hear him speak. I'll tell you that he's got a little video up on the web that we have a link to from our website that talks about the work that he did. And when I watched it, I cried. And I knew we'd landed a great person to come and speak at our banquet.
Oh, thank you. That's really sweet of you.
Yeah. And, well, now people are saying, well, what's the website?
Our website is www.wisconsinwetlands.org.
So they can go there and get a link to Carl's.
Yep, right on our homepage, you'll see a link to our conference, and he's under the banquet tab of that conference web suite.
Well, I really enjoyed your book, and I'm going to admit that I did not finish the entire book. I missed a couple of chapters. I just got it 2 days ago. So
oh, boy. Uh-huh.
So it was some long and fun evenings reading. But obviously you have a very long and deep connection to the environment at Lazy Point. And I think it's a great story just in and of itself, how you landed on Lazy Point, which is a pretty cool place.
Yeah, it's a very cool place, and it really is called Lazy Point. And it's on the eastern end of Long Island, just a few miles from the very tip of Long Island, which is Montauk Point. It's a bit of a peninsula that has a little harbor on one side and the sound on the north side, so it's sort of a triangular peninsula, and that's Lazy Point.
And you found this falling down house, shall we say? And
The house was a wreck when I saw it, and you know, it was the place that sold me, not the house. The house told me I would be crazy, but the place is fantastic. And then there was a saga about fixing up the house. I actually had a contractor come in, and he shook his head, and he said he had never seen a house so badly damaged, and he wouldn't know where to start, and he declined the job. So it was uphill for a while.
Well, and the house doesn't come into play very much in your book here. Talk about how you came to write this book and why you wrote this book.
Well, I wrote the book because, you know, I work on environmental things and conservation all the time, and there's a lot of gloom and doom regarding the environment. There's a lot of gloom and doom among conservationists. But I wanted to show in part that despite the gloom and doom, the world is still absolutely brimming with life. There is living vitality all around us. Many people don't really see it because they're not focused in on it. Lazy Point is a great place from which to see it because we have these incredible migrations that are all around us all year long. Birds, fish, whales, sea turtles, lots and lots of stuff that comes and goes. But really from many places, if you're keyed into it, you can see the same kinds of energies. But on the other hand, I did want to also show that there are these dangerous trends, and I wanted to explore why it is that we don't detect these trends, that the economy doesn't seem to recognize the danger, that our moral and ethical institutions don't seem to realize what's at risk. So the book is an exploration of all of that. It's a very personal and local book because it's set in this one little place, but it's also a global book because in the course of this year, we go to the high Arctic, we go all the way down to the Antarctic, and we go across half the tropics.
And I having spent quite a bit of time in the Caribbean myself, I taught at the University of the West Indies for a year and spent quite a bit of time traveling around the island, St. Lucia, St. Kitts Nevis, and so forth and so on. I had quite an interest in that chapter, those chapters of your book. And that's a really, you have a real gripping account of the efforts to save coral reefs, for example, from the devastation that they're facing.
Yeah, and one of the main things that I learned in the course of traveling there with an ecologist named Bob Stenick is that we think that the reefs exist because the corals just live there, and then the fish exist because they rely on the corals. But it goes both ways, because the coral reefs rely very heavily on having enough fish of particular kinds, especially parrotfish, that that graze the algae very, very short. The reefs rely on these fish to mow the lawn, essentially, and without them, or if they're overfished and the numbers are too low, the algae becomes leafy seaweed and it takes over the reef. And once that happens, the coral cannot maintain itself or get a foothold and come back. So not only do fish need the reef, but the reef very much needs the fish.
And we're losing our coral reefs around the world, pretty much.
Coral reefs in many places of the world are declining and degrading for a variety of reasons. One is that there are stresses that have allowed new diseases to proliferate. The stresses involve pollution, changes in the water clarity, changes in the temperature of the water, and changes in the acidity of the water from sources that range all the way from simply people living there and people fishing there, all the way to all of the oil and the coal that we all burn that is causing carbon dioxide to dissolve in the ocean, change the pH to turn the seawater more acidic, and that is slowing the growth of corals. So all of these different things are stacking up against coral reefs, and in many places they're declining. But the few places where they've done a good job to protect enough fish, the coral reefs are doing the best.
So there's some hope there.
There's always hope. Yes, absolutely.
Well, that was you took us from the Caribbean to, I believe, back to Lazy Point, but then on to Alaska. And I was really fascinated by your comments on salmon and how salmon affect the forests in Alaska.
Yeah, people think that the salmon just, are born in the streams and then they go in the ocean and then a few years later they come back and they lay their eggs in the streams and then they die, and that's all there is to it. But there's really a lot more to it, because what happens is that you have these baby salmon, they go out, they're very small when they go to the ocean. When they come back, they're much, much bigger. So what they've really done is they have turned the ocean and its nutrients into fish flesh. And then that flesh propels itself upstream against gravity, where, normally nutrients cannot flow against gravity. But these millions of fish go upstream, and then bears and eagles and lots of other creatures prey on them. They take them into the woods. All of those nutrients become the soil. The soil grows the trees. The trees shade the streams. They produce insects for the young salmon. And so the salmon grow the trees, and then the trees grow more salmon. And it's really an incredible system.
Oh, and you had a chance to observe the bears.
Oh, yeah. We saw plenty of bears at extremely close quarters.
Yeah, I think I remember you writing about one just sort of passing right within arm's length of you.
Well, at one point we were watching a couple of bears fishing in a stream, you know, about maybe 30 or 40 feet from us, and another bear simply walked right past me from behind me that I hadn't even known was there.
So, and the many of the, well, the birds at least for sure, that you observed in the Caribbean and elsewhere, make their way to Lazy Point at one time or another.
That was an incredible thing, was that many of the birds that I'm familiar with, which I think of as living at home at Lazy Point, I saw in the Caribbean, I saw in the Arctic. And, you know, of course, I've always known that they come from the north and they go south, and some of them come from the south and they come to us and they breed. But to actually keep running into them at these very far-flung points in my travels was really just fantastic.
Yeah. So you talk about a different way, that we need a different way of looking at our world and our environment if we're going to be around, essentially, because we're using resources at a rate that that can't be sustained.
Yes, but in a way, that's not quite the point. The point is that using them in a way that can't be sustained is wrong. Mm-hmm. There are actually a lot of people who are perfectly comfortable with the idea of using them, using resources or using land or even using people in a way that's not sustainable. For instance, if you're, let's say you're a company that kills whales, but that's only part of what your business is. You have a piece of your corporation that kills whales. You could say to them, well, if you kill all the whales, that's unsustainable and you'll go out of business. And they could say to you, well, that's fine with us, because if we kill them all, that will make the highest profits, and then we'll just invest those profits in another part of our company or in the stock market. So the point is not just the information that certain things are unsustainable. The point is that these things that are unsustainable are wrong. We have to marry the information with values, because the main thing that I learned in the course of all of these travels is that nature and human dignity require each other. If you think of a place like Haiti, where the people have not had basic human dignity for a long time. They've had terrible oppressive governments. They haven't had free speech. They haven't had democracy. In those situations, people are not able, because they're not the masters of their own fate, they're not able to maintain the nature around them. And as the nature gets destroyed, then the chances for them to get back on their feet and to have a future that is bright with prospects also fades away. So it goes both ways, that if we are going to be not only human beings, but to be humanized beings, we need to maintain the nature around us.
Our guests today, Carl Safina, who is the author of The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World, and Katie Bielfus, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Carl's going to be speaking at the association's conference in Baraboo in mid-February, and talking with them, talking with Carl about his book, and with Katie, we'll get to that. And just she's saying, well, you haven't said anything to me yet, or hardly anything.
Well, I could listen to Carl all day. This is great.
Well, at any rate, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along here. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer and our regular producer, for that matter, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with Carl Safina and also today with Katie Bielefus. Carl's book, The View from Lazy Point, it's a fascinating book. It's a natural year, the subtitle, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Katie Bielefus, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Again, if you'd like to join us with a question or comment, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Katie, just to tell us a little bit about the Wisconsin, you've been a guest on our program many times, but the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, tell us about that organization a bit.
Sure. Well, we're a nonprofit conservation organization. We're based here in the state of Wisconsin, and we work to protect and conserve wetlands both through a combination of outreach and policy efforts. I'm the Outreach Programs Director, so that's what I can talk best about. And one of our biggest programs that we offer is our annual conference, which we host for wetland scientists, wetland professionals, both university folks, agency professionals, and private citizens with an interest in wetlands as a venue for people to come together and share the latest information and science about wetlands, how they work, what we need to do to help manage and protect them, what some of the species that live in them need. So it's a wonderful opportunity to share this information and connect with that community of people. Now, Carl, I want to make clear, is speaking at our banquet, which is open to the public. The conference may or may not be of interest to you as a citizen, but we would welcome you to come and join us to hear Carl at our banquet. Mm-hmm. You do not need to come to the conference if you want to hear Carl. You can just come to the banquet.
Okay, and the banquet again is?
It's February 16th. It's Wednesday, and it's at 6:30 p.m., and it's up at the Ho-Chunk Casino in Baraboo, just 45 minutes up the road.
Okay, and so, again, I assume just people just go to your website.
Yep,
and
right at the top of our website, you'll see the reference to our conference. The Wetlands in a Landscape is the theme this year, and you can click right on there and follow all the information. If you have any questions, you can call our office at 608-250-9971.
250-9971, did you say?
That's right.
Carl, have you been to Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. I certainly have, several times.
I was just going to bring that up. You've been all over the world, and I assumed you'd been here.
I have. I've even been to the Crane Center, and I even spent a night in Aldo Leopold's shack.
Oh, well, you've got one up on me. I've been to the Crane Center, but I've never spent the night in Aldo Leopold's shack. That's cool.
I have too, Carl.
Oh, well, isn't it the coolest thing?
It is a life-changing experience. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you actually quote Leopold quite a bit in your book.
Well, he was such a giant, and, you know, he in all of the history of philosophy, he was really the first person to understand that people are part of nature.
Yeah, and his name pops up several times. We have an email from Ann in Superior for you, Carl. She says, most people don't understand that oxygen in the air is the result of photosynthesis and that much of that is made by phytoplankton. Are they in danger? And if so, by what?
Okay. So it's true that the oxygen in the air comes from green plants and from phytoplankton, which are single-celled organisms in the ocean that are very similar to green plants. They make the ocean plankton make about half of the oxygen that we breathe. The plankton populations are changing as the ocean temperatures change and as ocean pH changes. A lot of the nature of that change is not very well understood at the moment. In some places, it does seem to be declining, and the decline seems to be related to these large overall changes in the condition of the seawater and the temperature and the pH of the seawater. But I think it's the understanding of these changes is so new that it's really not understood very well at the moment.
I'm wondering, you paint, frankly, I mean, there are a lot of positives in your book, but you paint a kind of a bleak picture of our our chances, given our population, given the way most most countries look at the environment in which they live. You talk about democracy being the one way, I think you say it is the one way that we would maybe resolve a lot of our issues, but
it's certainly one of the ways. And I don't feel like the future is bleak. I feel like the trends are dangerous, and there's a lot at stake. One of the reasons that I write so much about these incredible populations of wildlife and these incredible natural habitats and how they relate to the well-being of people is to say that there's no reason to think that it's all lost or that we're past a quote tipping point. I can't stand it when people talk in those terms. There's a lot at stake, but whether it's bleak or not is beside the point. The point is that when we understand what's going on, we're fully capable of doing something about it, because the problems are of our causing, and the solutions could equally be of our causing.
Yeah. We had an email from Genevieve in Madison who says, what you know, Carl, about the harm and the problems in nature, can you really relax and enjoy being in nature, even so?
Well, I think if you can't find the sanity and the hope and the solace in watching these creatures just striving to survive and to maintain their lives in the course of their migrations in the course of the year, then you know you're really in worse shape than you need to be in. I mean, that's a conversation I had with myself many years ago, because it is true that when you read all the news, things can seem pretty bleak. But when you go out and you see the condition that the world is in, you realize that the game is very, very, very far from over.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. Talk a little bit more about Lazy Point, because I really enjoyed I really enjoyed your writing about your home and your area. It's a wonderful place.
It's a flat little place of scrubby pines. It's got the sound on one side, not Long Island Sound, but the sound that's between the two forks of eastern Long Island. It's got a little very shallow bay on the other side that's locally called the harbor, but for the most part it's too shallow for most boats to go into. There are a number of tern colonies totaling tens of thousands of breeding terns within 10 miles of the place on a couple of islands. Every week of the year, I would say, I don't think that's an exaggeration, every week of the year is different. There are different birds that are in the area. There are different birds migrating. There are different fish coming and going. In the midsummer, and also it's not just a matter of things go north in the spring and south in the fall, because many of the migrations overlap, and they even go in opposite directions at times. For instance, in the middle of the summer in late July, you have many of the local birds are still breeding and still raising their chicks, like the terns and some of the songbirds and the ospreys that we have. But the birds that have bred in the Arctic are finished. Summer is over in the Arctic pretty much by the end of July, and things are starting to turn a little bit cooler and more fall-like. So they start coming south even as the local birds are breeding. And meanwhile, there are some of the southern fish, like some of the tunas and the mahi-mahi and many of the small tropical fish that will arrive, are still working their way north and haven't gotten to us yet. They don't usually come until August or September. The water temperature actually peaks probably in the middle of September. So we have some of these tropical fish just arriving for a brief time when most of the local birds are massing up to leave. And it's just a spectacular place in this regard.
Well, I really enjoyed your writing about the fine balance that exists for those, for birds, for example, if things don't go just right, the insects aren't there, or they get there too early, and so forth, right, they're not going to make it.
Right. That's true. You know, you have a lot of the birds, because they're competing with each other for territories, they really push the envelope in the spring, and many of them arrive when conditions are a little dicey. If it's a nice spring, if it's a little warmer than average, they'll probably do okay. If they arrive and they've miscalculated and we have a late snowstorm or a late ice storm, a lot of them can be wiped out, the ones that are trying to get there early to get ahead of their competitors may wind up dying, and the ones that held back a little bit may be the ones that wind up with the territories. The other thing is that not every year is the same as far as the productivity of the local fruit, like the beech plum, mm-hmm, or the acorn,
yeah,
and the numbers of small fish change dramatically for reasons that people don't quite understand. It seems to me like it's related to how much rain we get in the spring, but a couple of scientists that I've some other scientists that I've asked about this, who've studied it in a little more detail than I have, say no, they don't. That doesn't seem to be it. To me, it seems to be it, but they've studied it a little bit more detailed. But what I do know is that some years there are not that many small fish, and other years there are just millions and millions of them. And how many young the seabirds raise, and how many of the fish, the bigger fish, you know, that eat the small fish, how many of them arrive and how long they stay changes from year to year. So the migrations change weekly, and they're different every year as well. So you never know.
We had an email from Ben in Green Bay who wanted to thank you for bringing up the morality of the issue. If that element isn't present, Ben says, then the debate changes based on gas prices and other temporary conditions.
Right. That's exactly right. And a thing that I think probably all conservationists that I know and most scientists that I know find very frustrating is we have a lot of really good information that gets better every year. We understand things better than we ever have, and yet information doesn't convince people about what to do. It's not until the information gets connected to their values that people are motivated to do something and to want to see certain policies go one way or another.
Yeah. Could you give an example of that?
Well, sure. I mean, energy policy, for instance, is a really good one and a really important one. Many people, as the emailer suggests, many people are just concerned about the price of gasoline at the pump. And yet, if you look at the full costs of energy, coal is a great example of that. Gasoline is another one, but coal is considered very cheap. It's cheap because there's a lot of it, but it's mainly cheap because when you buy a ton of coal, you only pay for a ton of coal. You don't pay for the cost of blowing the top off a mountain to get the coal. You don't pay for the cost of the early deaths to the miners who have been inhaling coal dust. You don't pay for the acidification of the streams from the mining. You don't pay for the change in the heat balance of the whole atmosphere or the acidification of the oceans that results, or the mercury that gets in the seafood from the coal smoke. You don't pay for any of that stuff. All of that is the real cost of coal, and yet the price, the value, and the cost are three different things that are simply not reflected by the economy at all, and that's why an extraordinarily costly source of fuel is made to look really cheap and is causing tremendous global problems and is preventing us from getting on with a phase into the clean energy economy that we will need. We cannot run the world on fossil fuels that are destabilizing the heat balance of the planet and will eventually run out.
Bill in Grand Chute has a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I have I'd like a response from your guest from Wisconsin. There was recently a decision in Green Bay where a commercial building permit was denied by the DNR in a wetland, commercial building application in a wetland in Green Bay denied by the DNR, and a specific piece of legislation was passed either this week or last, allowing that permit to go through in a specific area in that wetland. And my concern is that there may be a trend in that direction, and I'm wondering what your guest would have to say about it.
Okay.
Well, I think you did a pretty decent job of explaining most of the facts behind the situation. A couple of factual issues, but that's fine. I think the thing that our organization is interested in is making sure that our state's laws that protect wetlands are followed, and that the policies that are on the books are carried through. And we don't believe that in this case that was the situation. And as you pointed out, there is a piece of legislation. It's actually being discussed as we speak by the Senate Natural Resources Committee and was passed by the Assembly last week that would grant a special exception for one developer in that one particular site so that he doesn't have to follow the rules that the rest of the state has to follow. I object to that as a member of our democracy. I don't think that's what good legislation does. I think we have legislation that applies to everyone, and we don't do special case legislation, and that's the position of our organization right at this time.
Mm-hmm. Carl, thank you for calling. Carl, is that the kind of thing that happens in a lot of other places?
Well, unfortunately, sure, it does happen in a lot of other places, and I agree 100% with Katie. I mean, the whole point of our government and the whole reason the United States is supposed to be a relatively special country is that the laws apply to everybody equally, and people don't get to pick and choose which law they get to obey and which law they get to exempt themselves from. It's just really corruption.
And sometimes even the laws that we have, when we measure them against nature, for example, we find them wanting. I believe you had a great story. Well, I know you had a great story in your book about horseshoe crabs and walking along the beach. Tell that story and
sure. Well, the horseshoe crab is a very unusual animal. It kind of looks like a helmet with a spiky tail, and they've been around for something like 300 million years. They were ancient. They were ancient before dinosaurs even existed. And incredibly enough, they're still with us. They come to breed right along the shoreline on the full moon of May and June in our area. And they, as the tide is dropping, they lay their eggs in the intertidal zone. So their nests wind up above the tide line on most of the next few tides because the full moon makes the tides come up higher. So they try to keep their nests away from all the other things that would scour the nests, like lots of little crabs and lots of little scavenging snails. And, of course, once they're in the intertidal zone, they're vulnerable to other things. They're vulnerable to birds, which rely very heavily on the eggs during their migration. Some shorebirds do. But people have decided that horseshoe crabs are good for a couple of uses. One is to use them in traps for eels and whelks. And you would think that, most people have nothing to do with horseshoe crabs, but it turns out that the other use is that every batch of injectable and intravenous drug and every implantable device like an artificial hip or an artificial knee gets screened for bacterial contamination using a test that relies on horseshoe crab blood. So everyone relies on horseshoe crabs. And one night we were watching the horseshoe crabs coming up to breed, myself and my partner, and we were watching them in the shallows laying eggs, and the moon was full, and it was really a beautiful scene. And suddenly onto the beach comes a pickup truck with a fisherman who starts yanking every single female he can lay his hands on while she's laying her eggs, and throws it into the truck to use to bait his traps. So my partner, Patricia, immediately seeing what was going on, she started yanking every female she could lay her hands on and throwing them into deeper water where he couldn't get them. And she was soaked up to her neck, and he came racing his truck over to me and started, shall we say, a very lively debate on whether the right thing to do here was to take them or leave them, and how much is enough and how much is too much. The odd thing is that what he was doing was perfectly legal. They have a limit, or a thing that's called a limit, of 500 crabs a day that they can take. There were not 500 crabs along the whole beach that night. So, you know, it was a very tense discussion, but it made for an interesting dialogue.
Yeah, and sort of makes the point. Kyle, what are you going to be talking about at the Wetlands Association conference?
I'm going to be talking about many of my travels. I'm going to be talking about some of these broad themes. I'm going to be showing a lot of images from these trips, possibly some images from out in Lazy Point, and talking about the nature of nature and the relationship between human dignity and the rest of the world.
It's going to be a fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Katie, in terms of, I want to get back to that speech, because I know a lot of people are going to be interested in seeing it, and they can come, they can get online to your website.
Yep, we've got online registration for tickets, and so if you go to wisconsinwetlands.org and click on the link for the Wetlands in the Landscape Conference there. Actually, after this, I'm going to go home and put on a banquet banquet log right on the very front page so people can find that. We'd love to have you come up to Baraboo again. It's Wednesday, February 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Ho-Chunk Casino and Convention Center.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you for having us.
Fantastic.
Carl?
We'll see you then, Katie.
Thanks.
And I really appreciate being on.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks very much for being with us as well. Katie Bielfus, who is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, one of our guests. The other, Carl Safina. Carl is the author of The View from Lazy Point. It is fascinating. He's such a good writer.
Really amazing.
Isn't he? He's just an amazing writer. And I highly recommend this book. As I said, I have a couple chapters to go, but I'm telling you right now, I'll be taking the book back home with me and finishing those chapters and hanging on to it, because many of those chapters bear rereading, for sure. Thanks, Katie, and thanks, Carl. Well, coming up, we're going to switch gears a little bit. You ever think about riding a bicycle around the world? Scott Stoll did, and he thought about it, and then he went ahead and did it. And he wrote a book about it, and he has written a second book, and it is a book based on his four-year world bike tour, and it's aimed at children. The first book, of course, is aimed at, should I say normal adults? Scott's laughing off on the side here. It's called, the book's titled Falling Uphill, The Secret of Life. And he is going to join us next, as is Kate Kresick, who is a student resource teacher in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And she and her students played a role in this book that he, Scott's written for students, Falling Uphill. Scott Stoll, our guest, coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.